first case for this morning, 96-3356, 96-3588, 98-0029 W of Burnett v. Ault. And representing Attorney Burnett is, who is representing Burnett? Okay, you're representing yourself. Fine. That's what my notes say, but I just wanted to make sure. Okay, counsel, you have, according to this, 17.5 minutes, and then you will have a 2.5 minute rebuttal. And Attorney Guzzo will have 17.5 minutes and a 2.5 minute rebuttal. Is that correct? All right. And then we have Attorney Men for 10 minutes. Attorney Grimstead for 10 minutes. That makes 20. What are you going to do with the other 10? On my notes.
I think it adds up to an hour.
Does it add up to an hour? Okay.
I think the order I can follow would have been going to be Mr. Yellows would have been possibly Mr.
Pardon me?
I think the order of one of Mr. Yellows would have been possibly Mr. Grimstead has argued that the matter would be fine for all
of us. Okay. Chief, could you have him go through verbally the order? All right. Why don't you take the podium so that we know what everybody is going to do? We'll see if we can follow that. If not, you'll be happy to correct me and I won't take offense. All right? Will you argue first? Okay. Mr. Burnett?
We're not going to have any arguments about this order now, are we?
All right.
May it please the court. My name's George Burnett, and I'm here on behalf of Dr. Ernesto Acosta and on behalf of myself as a petitioner. This case involves two issues. The first issue is whether Dr. Acosta may be compelled to serve as an involuntary expert on the plaintiff's behalf. And the second issue is whether or not my position taken in a discovery position had substantial justification as 804.12 of our statutes requires. In the 17 and a half minutes I have to speak, I'm going to try to touch on 6 points, 3 on the first issue and 3 on the second issue. I'm going to start on the issue of whether or not Dr. Acosta may be forced to serve as an involuntary expert on the plaintiff's behalf. And in beginning that argument, I'll start where this matter began at the circuit court, and that's with a federal decision, Reed versus Featherstone, cited at 785 F. Sup. 1352. Briefly stated, in Reed versus Featherstone, there was a medical malpractice action brought in federal district court before Judge Reynolds. The plaintiff's counsel attempted to elicit from a Dr. Beaumont certain medical opinions about whether or not the target defendant had met the standard of care. Dr. Beaumont was not a party to the action and, in fact, had treated the plaintiff for certain orthopedic injuries following the auto accident that ultimately led to the medical malpractice action. The district court held that Dr. Beaumont was what it called a transaction witness, and it said as a transaction witness, his testimony is limited to questions that were within Dr. Beaumont's knowledge. In other words, what he had to offer based on the scope of his treatment of the plaintiff. The case here is very similar because Dr. Acosta was the prenatal obstetrician for the Ault family. And he, by virtue of the rules of his practice, wrote the discharge summary. In that discharge summary, he observed that two things had occurred during the pregnancy based on his review of the record. The first, that there had been a ruptured placenta, and the second, that the all child was suffered had suffered from fetal distress. Now,
counsel, did Dr. Acosta have to review the records in order to prepare the discharge summary? Does the record reflect that?
The first deposition shows that in 1989, shortly after this delivery, he did review the hospital chart, and particularly the monitoring strips and other notes about the condition of the labor and delivery and reaching those conclusions.
What additional research would he have to do in order to answer all of those questions at the deposition then?
That's a complicated question and one that I'm not able to answer specifically because I know very little about the medicine involved in this case, but let me tell you this, that the plaintiff has named some 13 medical experts to support its case. I understand that the defense has named...
Are you able to answer my question?
Yes.
What additional research would he have to do in order to answer all of those questions in the deposition?
In order to responsibly answer those questions, I think he'd have to review the deposition transcripts of the plaintiff's experts and the defense experts in order to evaluate the respective opinions and ultimately determine whether the standard of care was met or not.
Was he in the same area being asked for opinions on medical matters?
Yeah, he was a board-certified obstetrician gynecologist and was Dr. Klein's partner.
So some of the questions put to him were for his opinion on various medical procedures?
My anticipation is that those questions would have been asked based on letters from plaintiff's counsel, but for the fact that the deposition terminated after about an hour of questioning. The important point is that Reed versus Featherston holds that a transaction witness is obliged to answer questions as an expert witness only to the extent that he has a personal familiarity or knowledge with the case. Here we were prepared, Dr. Acosta was prepared to answer questions about his prenatal care and the observations he made in the discharge summary and the basis for those observations. The questioning that occurred at the deposition surpassed that. It went beyond that. The second...
We're dealing with two questions, are we not, counsel?
Yes, we are. The first question was whether or not...
What he would have done.
Yes, what he would have done with regard...
What requires the expertise there? Why do you say that's part of his expertise?
That's what Reed versus Featherstone...
Yeah, but Reed versus Featherstone is a federal district court, one judge. I'd like to know what you have to say.
Dr. Acosta would have done would have been completely irrelevant because it doesn't meet the standard of care and probably would have been inadmissible even at the trial of this matter. The appropriate question to an expert in a deposition is what is the standard of care, not what your level of care would have been. The second question was...
Did you make that objection clear on the record?
I made that objection, and that is the question that the trial court... indicated I was appropriate in redirecting the doctor not to answer. So that's not a question that, at least in my view, we're here about today. The second question was whether in a full-term pregnancy a gush of blood was abnormal. And my basis for objecting to that question was... At that point in time in this deposition, I thought that Dr. Acosta was being asked to serve as the obstetrical consultant to the plaintiffs. And I thought Reed versus Featherston and a series of other cases from other jurisdictions forbade that. Those other jurisdictions include New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and California, as well as others mentioned in the briefs, all of which have adopted a rule that says absolutely no expert may be compelled to serve on an involuntary basis at the behest of a litigant.
Why not? Why not? I'm there. I see an accident. I'm an eyewitness. Court or one of the litigants can come in and haul me in. I can spend a day or two or three sitting around waiting for you guys to get your depositions in order. I can spend several days in court. I get no pay or very little pay. Why? You take my time. Why shouldn't you take the doctor's time?
Because...
And this was a treating physician. This woman was her patient, wasn't she?
Yes, she was a patient.
What's the matter with asking him what he would have done?
For two reasons. First of all, in order to answer questions responsibly, an expert witness needs to study the matter. If litigants are allowed to bring experts into the deposition room and force them to answer questions directly or in a hypothetical basis, what we're actually eliciting is testimony that's based upon half-considered views. Now, of course, the opportunity always exists to clarify that on cross-examination, but nevertheless, I think that strong policy reasons exist to require witnesses to study a matter fully before they give sworn testimony.
Well, we have in our rules of evidence specifically allowable testimony by experts as hypotheticals. And you're right, under cross-exam, you can go into the basis of the hypotheticals, and there's even an instruction that indicates if the premise of the hypotheticals was not shown, then the jury is to disregard the hypothetical testimony. So, I mean, we have quite a developed area of law dealing with hypothetical expert witness testimony. And so why can't we just continue with that well-developed area of law?
Because where this occurred was at the discovery stage, and at the discovery stage, the scope of the testimony that is allowed is far broader. And as the trial court noted, testimony from Dr. Acosta may not be admissible at trial, but it certainly should be discoverable under some circumstances.
Why couldn't the response of Dr. Acosta have been, I haven't studied this matter, so I cannot answer that as an expert. I can only give you my opinion as a layperson based on my perceptions.
I think to many questions that very well could be the response. But my question is where does that ultimately lead us? Basically, we're spending time in depositions with an expert who is not...
Well, it leads us to making Dr. Acosta not an expert, but simply giving an opinion testimony by a lay witness, which is covered by a rule.
Right. On a matter that I think the court's precedent requires expert testimony.
That's your response.
That's my response.
What about an expert that perhaps doesn't have the perhaps that does not have the same degree of expertise as a medical doctor? Let's say I have an expert on maintenance work. I don't know, as a layperson, all that much about what the standard of care for a maintenance person is. But, of course, if we deal with rules and the law, rule of law concerning experts, it's just not medical experts. It's expert maintenance men, it's expert traffic people, it's expert engineers, it's expert everything. So why can't I have an expert maintenance man testify, although he's a non-party, to what a reasonable standard of maintenance care is in a building just such as this?
You can, and as a matter of fact, the court addressed that issue in the Filler case back in 1910 or 1911. And what the court said in Filler is this. It said, Filler involved a case in where a doctor examined a defendant in a criminal matter on insanity. And what the court said in Filler is this, that physician has no right to withhold testimony simply because he's a doctor. If he made certain observations in the course of his treatment, factual observations of material facts, he is obliged to provide them just like a real estate appraiser would be obliged to discuss those facts he observed about the condition of real estate. The court said the more difficult question becomes when you enter upon the real area of expert testimony, and that is opinions. What conclusions do you draw from those material facts that you observed? And in Filler, the court suggested that those areas are the subject of expert testimony and may not be compelled from an expert on an involuntary basis. Now, in the Reynolds...
Even if the expert has an answer and doesn't need a lot of research?
The court in Filler suggested that if the answer to a question is a simple one, the expert should provide it.
Doesn't Filler say, however, if he does perform work in preparation and qualification at the request, so it's like arguably an interpretation of the Reynolds Federal District case, if you do work in preparation and anticipation, but that's distinguished, at least arguably, from giving an opinion that requires no extra work or preparation, but one that is already within your knowledge. And Filler makes that distinction.
Filler makes that distinction, and that's the same distinction that we're making here. Dr. Acosta is an involuntary expert. He has not performed work at the request of either litigant. In Filler and in the Reynolds case, which talks about Filler, to some extent it suggests that much of the language in Filler may well be dicta, both cases involve situations where a litigant was, where an expert was retained by a litigant. And under those circumstances, that expert has no ability to protest should he be subjected to a subpoena by the adversary.
Mr. Burnett, yes, let me ask you a couple of questions. To begin with, it's my understanding that Judge Dyer, the trial judge in this case, found that you had violated his order in regard to discovery. Can you tell us what that order was?
The order that Judge Dyer said I violated was to allow Dr. Acosta's testimony to proceed, and the court would rule upon matters of admissibility later. Judge Dyer was modeling that order based on 80405, I believe, which is what the statute says. I don't believe I violated that order, even in Judge Dyer's mind, because of the two questions I directed the witness not to answer, he said one was appropriate and one was not.
Did he expect by that order, did he ever clarify that he expected by that order that what would happen was that you'd register your objection and then go ahead and let the answer be given by the witness? I mean, was that the anticipation of Judge Dyer?
I didn't read that into the order. What I understood from what Judge Dyer's reference was there, Mr. Johnson read that order into the record in the deposition, was that the testimony would be given and that there were to be no further continuances or impediments to Dr. Acosta's testimony.
Well, the Court of Appeals, as I understand it, was critical of you on two instances. Basically, they said, given the circumstances that developed, you could have done one of two things. You could have either called Judge Dyer and asked for a telephonic ruling on the question, or you could have sought a protective order. I guess my question to you is, why did you not do one or the other?
Hindsight is 20/20, and certainly I wish I had. The response is, at this stage of the proceedings, I anticipated a wholesale debate over the scope of that testimony, and that I thought it was best to go to the deposition, see what questions were asked, and then try to refine our positions. Obviously, that wasn't the most efficient way to do it. The second thing is that I had a genuine concern about was the posture that I would be at the trial court at. I would be there saying, Judge, I suspect they may ask some questions of Dr. Acosta about standard of care and other things that Reed versus Featherstone forbids, but I can't be sure. Would you please issue a prophylactic ruling that stops them from doing that? I suspect, based on my experience with most trial judges would give some general guidance, like Judge Dyer did even after the second deposition here, and then tell the parties to proceed, and he would answer the questions on a case-by-case basis. The third explanation is by the time this whole matter crystallized after the exchange of these three letters on each side, I was in a three-week medical malpractice trial, and I only had a few days before this deposition was scheduled.
Counsel, on what legal basis did you instruct the witness not to answer? On what legal authority? I didn't get that.
The legal basis was the Eggleston case out of the Seventh Circuit. I've been practicing for 17 years, and I can tell you that in 17 years, I have instructed a witness not to answer questions less than half a dozen times.
I'm sorry. what was that legal, I mean, I know there's the case, but what's the basis, on what legal authority did you rely on?
The Eggleston case says, under the identical federal rule, that it is appropriate to tell a witness not to answer questions on matters of privilege and on matters that are offensive. Eggleston was a race discrimination case.
Chief, I have one further question.
I note that the practice manual, or I guess it's a Wisconsin...
State Bar publication?
No, it's that Harvey book, Grinnick and Harvey. It indicates that when you have an objection on privilege, it says on page 504, however, where the objection raised is based on privilege, it is not sufficient merely to note the objection for the record. The attorney invoking the privilege should halt the deposition and apply for a protective order pursuant to 80401 sub 3. Is that the understanding of the law of the state of Wisconsin?
I have not read the Harvey book, but I wouldn't disagree with that.
What privilege?
The privilege is found in 907.05 or 06, I believe.
Is work product?
No, it's a privilege that is inherent in the statutes, and the argument that was made in the briefs was that because 905.01 mentions no such privilege for an expert witness, it must not exist. That statute says that if the privilege is inherent in the statutes, it does exist. 907.04 indicates that if a trial judge is to call his own expert, then that expert can only be called if he consents. My point is that it would be an aberration to allow lawyers to call experts without their consent, but to confine the trial court's power.
Well, then you're asking for a broader privilege than Filler or the Featherston cases would indicate.
Yes, and the reason I'm doing that is because of the Davidson case that suggests that not, if the privilege is not in 905.01 or in the inherent in the statutes, then the privilege no longer exists. So there's a real question over whether or not Filler and Reynolds are still good law in Wisconsin based on that statute. The other thing I would mention, and then my time is long up, is that the rules, that the order that the court entered enacting 905.01 allows the court to amend that rule by individual decision if it so desires.
The statute you cited, you must have miscited, because its opinion and ultimate issue is 907.04, and 907.05 is disclosure of underlying facts. Is there another statute?
Yes, it's 907.06, which deals with court-appointed experts. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bozo.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Tom Gilzo. I represent Mark and Dawn Ault, along with Kobe Ault, Jim Johnson, guardian ad litem, also appears here at council table with me. 20 years ago, I was appointed as ad hoc member to judicial counsel to take a look at discovery abuses in Wisconsin. We sent a survey to some of you who may have received it at that time, asking what were the problems in the conduct of cases, particularly with regard to discovery. 15 years ago, now retired Judge Dick Long ran the trial ad course here at the University of Wisconsin. We met then at the Madison Club and tried to ask what we could teach the kids, the students, about discovery abuses so they didn't become the teachers and abusers in Wisconsin in years that followed. 10 years ago, I monitored for the state bar the view of the bench, where I went around the state with trial judges. Our sole purpose was to educate the bar, as well as the public, about abuses in our state. Today, I stand before you to tell you about the worst case of abuse of a civil process I've been a part, or I know, or I've read of in case law anywhere. The focus of your discussion so far has dealt on Dr. Acasa. May I just see that, please? Dr. Acasa was the mother's doctor. was the doctor for the fetus in this case, which became the live, severely brain-damaged Cody Ault. On my brief, without going through it at great length in the time I'm allocated, one must remember, when I took this man's deposition, this physician, almost 4 years ago, I went through a laborious qualification of this doctor. I pointed out that he had read the perinatal record. He had written the discharge summary on this baby. He had talked to the defendant, Dr. Klein, before he did it. He talked to all of the delivery nurses. He had several conferences with a delivering doctor, his partner. They work in the same, for the same firm. They're insured by the same carrier. All before he dictated his opinions as required by Wisconsin Administrative Code in the discharge summary, and he found that baby, Cody Ault, to a reasonable degree of medical probability at that time of delivery to have fetal distress.
Counsel, may I interrupt for a moment?
Yes, sir.
The question that I have is this. Would we be here? Why didn't you call him as an expert and accordingly pay him?
Why didn't I call him adversely?
Call him as an expert.
He was. In fact, he was, Your Honor. We named him as an expert, as is required, as you know, because we were going to elicit opinions from him. I was taking his deposition so that we could use his factual basis for which he had drawn his conclusion, precisely pointing to the fetal heart monitor, which any OBGYN is going to be using today all over this city, let alone this state, to take a look at the condition of the fetus as registered by the monitor. And he is pointing to the exact moment when he determined this child was in fetal distress. I was gathering all those facts before counsel earlier walked out of the deposition. Right in response when I'm saying, when exactly was this child in distress for, as you all know, minutes are everything. And we have a two-hour tape from the time this doctor was telling me this child was in fetal distress until ultimately the child was delivered.
So you were asking him these two questions in his capacity as an expert?
Without a doubt. How he got his opinion. Doctor, what is the basis for your opinion? And remember, his opinion is that which is in the medical record, which when we start the case is sent to us. And you look who dictated the discharge summary. I mean, these are all the records there. This isn't my expert per se, named as an expert. This is an eyewitness to the event. And he concluded based upon his own history, board certified OBGYN, all of the appropriate background. He tells me, he teaches people in how to read the fetal heart monitor sheet. And I essentially said, what's the basis for your opinion, doctor? And he gave me that basis. And from that point, you recall, they walked out of the deposition, they were sanctioned, it goes to the appellate court, and my friend Mr. Burnett comes back to represent him in what should have been really like a 1.5-hour deposition. These folks weren't even a party to the lawsuit. And it's the point, well, let's continue to see if you really can continue 3 years later, after, with all due respect, the lawyers have done their work, and you ask essentially the same questions. This time, he tells us he won't even give us his opinion because you don't diagnose from a fetal heart monitor. That evidence is spoliated. That evidence, that key critical witness, that testimony is gone. I think conceptually it may be helpful to remember one of the arguments I saw in their briefs is you have 13 experts. They don't talk about how many are OBGYNs. But remember what the expert does. An expert looks at the medical record, looks at the testimony given by these eyewitnesses, namely the nurses who are there literally to take care of the mothers of this world. And they look at what the doctors have said occurred when the event occurred, and then they formulate their opinions. On either side, that's the expert. The real players are those that were there at the moments of the birth of this child. And when I tried to take those depositions, you recall Mr. Men interrupted those depositions with hundreds and hundreds of objections the judge found to be flagrant to such a degree he concluded the entire discovery process was worthless. And if you read that testimony, ask yourselves how you can go back today and ask a nurse, 9 years, this child is 9 years old a week and a half ago, and I'm talking about an event that occurred at the day of his birth.
Counselor.
Yes. I'm sorry?
I want to know about the issues. The opposing counsel indicates that the issue is, the first issue is, I think, whether or not Dr. Acosta can be made to testify as a serve as an involuntary expert witness. The Court of Appeals treated these issues as whether or not the court reasonably exercised its discretion. It seems to me that in treating a case of reasonable exercise of discretion, that's different than the issue as stated by your opposing counsel, which, if either, is correct. And if you choose not the discretionary, why shouldn't we just decide this case based on whether or not there's a reasonable exercise of discretion? Number one, should we decide the case just based on reasonable exercise of discretion, and if not, why not, I guess?
I think clearly, to answer you, the clear focus has always been in this case until what I will call, with all due respect, the pedagogical puffery began to try to aggrandize this as an issue as though this witness should be handled with a special category, unlike anything we've ever known in the state of Wisconsin. And the appellate court had to see through that and dealt with this as an abuse of discretion relative to discovery. Because when you put this down to the simplest detail, ask yourself, what would have been the harm if the question were asked? Answer. The question itself is about as banal a question as you can ever get into. But what we're running into is a lawyer who chooses to put the words in the mouth of the witness. The witness didn't say, I can't answer that, I'm unqualified, you didn't pay me. No issues like that were ever raised. I don't think I'm capable of doing that. And remember, 804 says you answer that question and you give your objection and we'll rule on it later. And what makes this more, forgive me, repugnant, because it does, as an officer of this court, make it repugnant, is when the attorney is read the order given by the trial judge Dreyer right on record, and he says, you shall answer, and we can take that up later. That's a paraphrase. More accurately, answer the question. That's simply boilerplate 804. And if you think Gilzo or Johnson is asking the wrong question, get your objection here. We can rule on it. If we really did a terrible job evidentiary-wise, it couldn't be admitted. Motion in limine would be granted. It would be stricken. What's the harm? But we've learned in our state since we've begun this, we serve the purpose better of justice and truth. If we let that testimony come out, we give our objections, as long as your questions are reasonably calculated to lead to admissible evidence. Listen, if you may, if you would, listen to the question. Quote, no matter what the cause, a patient with a history of term pregnancy and a gush of blood, that's abnormal. Close quote. What does it matter? What somebody says, yes. Well, could that lead to something admissible? Yeah, doctor, why would you say that for? Because we had a gush of blood. You know there's a gush of blood. We could talk about that as the basis for his opinion. If he says no, what's the difference? But don't we serve this court, our judicial process, by letting that come out? And if it's wrong, you get your objection made. We can rule on the objection. And we've been doing that for almost 30 years in this state. But when lawyers jump in and say, don't you answer that question, remember how restrictive we are. Forgive me for preaching to you folks. Remember how restrictive we are. We don't get to say, don't answer the question, unless they're self-incriminating and very, very few other things in Wisconsin. And when you jump in a case like this that has a history of almost 6 years before your participation, at the risk of repeating the brief...
Counsel.
Look at, I'm sorry.
All right. I want to go back to Justice Babbage's question. I guess we agree he's a transactional witness because he has seen the Miss Ault before birth and then after, right? So he's a transactional witness to something. And you're calling him that way, is that right?
I mean, your answer to his question is you're calling him as an expert witness, and he's your expert witness. Is that right?
No. He really, I have to name him, remember, because if I ask anybody for opinions and I haven't named him in my free trial order, I couldn't use him.
You've named
him. But I'm asking him for his opinions, the basis for his conclusions.
All right. So you're dealing with him as an expert witness. I understand, Mr. Burnett, and I may be taking him a little farther than he wants to be taken. He might say that this is an expert witness, that you can ask him his name, rank, serial number, social security number, medical license number, but not much else, because he's an expert witness, and if you want to talk to him, you ought to pay him.
Okay.
I mean, and that's the privilege. He's got his medical degree, he's got all this expertise that he's gotten at a high cost to himself, and if you want it, you should pay for it.
You recall in my brief I said we would. Our statute said if they require that, we would pay that. No request was ever made when we walked in there. No one ever suggested until a brief for the appellate courts this issue had something to do with payment. And if I may go further,
suppose he says, I don't want to be your expert witness. You can pay me $1 million, but I don't have to be your expert witness.
We have that every day.
Right.
I may call a witness and they decline not to be there.
Right.
But remember, this is a witness who was there for the mom. This is the mom and the baby, and they formulated the opinions. And if they can simply say to us, I'm not going to give it to you because I don't care, I delivered your child, I don't want to give it to you.
That's why the question of what you're calling for seems so important to me. If you're calling him as a transactional witness, then your questions have to deal with what he saw, what he knew. He's an eyewitness or whatever you want to call him here. And he ought to answer that. It doesn't matter whether he's a person on the street that saw the accident or he's a physician. If you're calling him an expert witness, we got a different problem here. We may have a different problem. And so I'm trying to get from you, you're calling him as an expert witness, but you didn't offer him any money. And even if you had offered him money, he could say, I'm not coming as your expert witness. We've established that as a general rule. So why are you now, my punchline is, why are you now complaining that he doesn't answer your questions?
He's an expert witness
and he doesn't want your money. I mean, that's putting it as crass as I can think of at the moment.
Respectfully, this doesn't have anything to do with the money. This has to do with the truth, the basis by which this man formulated his opinion. That's all that I was asking for. When they talked about transitional witnesses, it may be because, and I submit it is, if I had asked him to do something that required him to do work that he hadn't been prepared to do, then we go to the case that says, indeed, I haven't done those research, I haven't given it, and if you want me to do it, you're going to have to pay me.
Well, I don't think lawyers approach that way. If a client asks you a question that you know the answer to without doing a lot of research, nevertheless, you can still bill that client. Now, why shouldn't the doctor be able to say, hey, I'm not going to answer a question that requires my expertise that is outside of what I witnessed unless I am an expert? Unless I'm designated as an expert and paid as an expert, I'm not going to give away my education or my experience.
I think what you're arguing is what is firmly established in the statutes that says if someone is used as an expert witness and you wish to call them, you will have to give them reasonable pay. I don't have any dispute with that at all. But what the court has to understand, that was never requested.
Mr. Gilzall,
there's an issue here that you can't get opinions from a CASA until you pay him for those opinions.
Mr. Gilzall, let me ask you a couple of questions, if I might. The Court of Appeals suggested that one of the remedies here, when this occurred during the course of the deposition, was to call Judge Dyer and get a ruling. Now, they were critical of Mr. Burnett because he didn't do that. Why didn't you do that?
Well, technically, I wasn't there. And I did not go. If you're asking me why I don't think it was done, I can tell you what I've learned from Mr. Johnson.
Who was the attorney that was there representing your clients? Mr. Johnson?
And Mr. Centeno from my office.
Why didn't one of them do that?
Because the time in which it was interrupted, was not on a question that could have permitted the judge, we think, to clearly rule. If you'd have said normally to a judge when you call them, and I have, "Judge, we have a question before you," quote, "no matter what is the use, a patient with a history of pregnancy and a gush of blood, is that a normal? What is your ruling, yes or no?" would not have gotten us anywhere, because we had a lawyer who was saying, "I'm not going to let him testify to anything as to his, regarding his expertise." So we had a whole line of questioning, presumably that they only knew wherein we would enter the issue, the area that was prohibited.
Well, why couldn't one of the attorneys have called the judge and said, "Here's our problem. This is what Mr. Burnett is doing on behalf of Dr. Acosta. We want to be able to pursue this line of questioning. Give us your ruling. Tell us what to do, Judge."
I think technically you could do that. I believe if we look at how we'd want to do it in this issue at this time, it would be far better to have given the judge a brief to support the comments of counsel that are, this witness has an absolute privilege, unrecognized in our state. That is their position. He is absolutely privileged to not give any sworn testimony, quote, if he doesn't want to.
Well, instead of the attorneys representing the alts calling the judge and getting a ruling, it's my understanding that what they did was present this matter by motion to Judge Dyer, asking for sanctions. Now, wouldn't it have been much more direct and much more efficient to call on the telephone? If Burnett was supposed to do that, why not Mr. Johnson?
I think it's a fair question. I mean, that the drive to say, "Could you both do it?" I think I would have trouble even here with credibility telling the court, if I believe a trial judge is facing a lawyer who says he believes the law in Wisconsin gives a, quote, absolute privilege, close quote, to doctors that they do not have to answer questions if they do not want to. I don't know how a judge could rule on that without some kind of brief, without some understanding, and saying, "I'm supposed to do that in an instant." That's a lot of gravity, a lot of heavy expectation, I think, to put on trial judges. I believe the better way to do it is the way in which we did it, which was not by choice, but we're forced to say, "This deposition again is over. If you want to do anything about it, Mr. Gilzo, then you petition the court for your sanctions, because he's not going to tell you anything else." You know, I think your focus is a good one, to say, does it cut both ways? Of course it cuts both ways. But the use, you want me to stop? The use of that telephone, I think, can be really effective. And I've seen it done where there's a question that really deals with form and say, "Your Honor, if you have the time, can we get a ruling?" And they read it right off the court reporter's transcript, and he can make a ruling and you can go on. But when you're really talking about a brand new law that warrants us to come before the Supreme Court to be judged by a trial judge after 3 years of abuses in the case that got us to that point, it's a great deal to expect from our trial judges are going to be able to resolve that by a phone call.
Do you have any other questions just for anybody else? Thank you,
thank
counsel.
You.
We'll hear from Attorney Men.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Jonathan Men. I represent Appleton Medical Center, and I'm here in response to the plaintiff's petition for a supervisory writ. As Your Honors may have gleaned from the briefs, I am not involved with the Acosta dispute, but the plaintiff has petitioned for a supervisory writ against me and the other defendants as a result of matters, in my case, objections at depositions of three nurses some 5 years ago. In response to plaintiff's petition, in the 10 minutes I have, I've got 3 points that I'd like to try to make. Number one, the issue before that's involved here regarding sanctions, what sanctions are appropriate, is a discretionary decision. In this case, the trial court and the Court of Appeals have repeatedly, on more than one occasion, considered the very points that the plaintiffs are now attempting to raise by means of a petition for a supervisory writ. And on every single occasion, both the trial court twice and the Court of Appeals once have said that the sanctions invoked by the trial court, which were significant against me and against Attorney Grimstad, were appropriate. They did not require the entry of default judgment against my client, Appleton Medical Center, or for that matter, against Mr. Grimstad's client, Dr. Klein, that they were appropriate under the circumstances. And particularly, the Court of Appeals, in its decision, and this is R-108, said, the record reflects the circuit court's examination of relevant facts, application of the proper standard of law, a rational process, and a conclusion a reasonable judge could reach, and it did not erroneously exercise its discretion by imposing the sanctions. And while I would love to be able to argue to your honors that I think that the sanctions were too harsh, and so on and so forth, that what I did was right, the trial court and the Court of Appeals found against me. I can't take that position. I can say that what I did was based upon my reading of the law and the facts. I was found against. But the court imposed significant sanctions, and it was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. It was a rational basis. There is no basis here for now, 5 years after the fact, saying, well, we're going to second-guess everybody and enter judgment against the hospital. These decisions are not manifestly clearly erroneous or abuse of discretion, and therefore I don't see any basis for granting a supervisory writ at this time. Secondly, and in that regard, I, individually as the lawyer, and my client, Appleton Medical Center, has fully complied with all orders and sanctions entered by the trial court and affirmed by the Court of Appeals. We've done nothing since that time that the plaintiff has complained of. There's been no new facts or anything like that. I simply don't see how it's fair or any basis in fact or law to now punish me a second time by saying, well, the sanctions weren't harsh enough, we're going to enter default judgment against the hospital. Bear in mind, Your Honors, that the Court of Appeals and the trial court had the full and complete record of all of the things that the plaintiff is complaining about when it rendered its initial decisions in 1994 and again on the motion for reconsideration in 1995. In fact, the only thing that the plaintiff in his petition raises new has to do with some letters from Attorney Grimstad, nothing regarding the hospital. With respect to my client, the full and complete record of all of these problems and complaints were before the courts.
Counsel,
yes.
Forgive me for not knowing the answer to this question, but it just totally escapes me.
Sure.
What sanctions were imposed against you?
The sanctions against me were, number one, I could not call those three nurses as witnesses in the trial of this case, which I think is very significant. Number two, I have to pay for the depositions of those three nurses. And number three, the plaintiff could redepose those nurses. Now, he's chosen not to do so. He could have done that back in 1994. So those are the three basic sanctions.
Thank you.
The final point here is that this matter comes before your honor.
Excuse me.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor.
Question. Did the Court of Appeals directly address the questions of sanctions against you? They said in this footnote, I know, that we note that the plaintiff's asked us to order certain defenses struck because we hold the trial court's imposition of monetary sanctions proper. We do not address plaintiff's contention that harsher sanctions should be imposed. That footnote applies to you as well? Is that what you're saying? Is that where they addressed it?
Well, the Court of Appeals decision, are you looking at the one from 1994?
You're talking about the first court.
The first court of appeals. Yes,
okay.
Your Honor. I was only involved in that appeal.
Gotcha.
Okay. And which kind of leads to my last point, namely that on a petition for a supervisory writ, I don't think that the plaintiffs are entitled to that because they have not shown the proper legal basis for your courts entertaining a petition for supervisory writ under Section 809.71. I raised at my brief, beginning at pages 12 through about 18, I discussed the Section 809.71, which is what the plaintiffs have filed under, in great detail. Nothing in the plaintiff's reply brief responded to that. They have not contradicted that. The fact of the matter is, under the statute, in order to even be granted or eligible for a petition for supervisory relief, the person seeking a supervisory writ from the Supreme Court shall first file a petition for a supervisory writ in the Court of Appeals. They never did that. Secondly, The Supreme Court, it states in the Judicial Council Committee's note, says the Supreme Court will not exercise its supervisory jurisdiction where there is an adequate remedy at law. Here, the plaintiff clearly had an adequate remedy at law. If the plaintiff back in 1994 felt that sanctions were not harsh enough, that the case had to be granted judgment in their favor, they could have petitioned this court for appeal. The sanctions available are set forth under Section 804.12, the discovery sanction, so they clearly had an adequate remedy at law. Furthermore, the Dressler case, which I cite at page 13 of my brief, points out that a supervisory writ will not lie where purely discretionary matters are involved, and that's exactly what we have here. For all of these reasons, the plaintiff pursued remedies, pursued an appeal, pursued a request for reconsideration. They never petitioned for a supervisory writ. I just quite frankly think that a supervisory writ is inappropriate here. It's not designed to go to the issue of discretionary sanctions, which have been issued by a trial court, affirmed by the Court of Appeals. The plaintiffs decide to do nothing about it. They don't appeal. They never ask for a supervisory writ. And now 5 years later, they say, by the way, even though the hospital has fully complied with all the orders and sanctions, we want them whacked again. I just don't see any basis in fact or law or equity for doing that, and I haven't heard anything either from Attorney Gilzo or in his brief that addresses these points. Consequently, Your Honors, I would request that you deny plaintiff's request for a supervisory writ insofar as it pertains to the hospital, and for that matter, insofar as it pertains to Dr. Klein as well. And although I have a little bit of time, if you don't have any questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Attorney Penn. Attorney Grimstead, you're arguing on behalf of Richard Klein.
May it please the Court. I'm Paul Grimstead. I represent Dr. Klein and his medical clinic, which is Women's Health Care. I'm from Manitowoc. I have 10 minutes to talk to you about our position in this matter. Let me just begin by saying that where I got in trouble in this case, apparently, is because I was Dr. Acosta's first lawyer. When this lawsuit started, Dr. Klein was named as a defendant, and so was his clinic, Women's Health Care. The complaint alleged that Dr. Klein was negligent, and it also alleged that other members of the clinic were negligent. As is and was the practice in medical cases then and now, I, as counsel for the clinic, felt that I had the right to speak with the patient, with the patient's doctors, those doctors who treated the patient. In order to defend the clinic, I felt I had to be able to talk to the doctors. And so I met with Dr. Acosta, who was the only other doctor in the clinic who had treated this lady, other than Dr. Klein. And as we prepared the defense, I undertook the representation of Dr. Acosta, the clinic, and Dr. Klein, even though Dr. Acosta was not named as a party. As I indicated, this is the way things were done. If the hospital gets sued and you represent a hospital, you go talk to the nurses. They're the ones who render the care. If a clinic gets sued, you have to go talk to the doctors. They're the ones that render the care. At any rate, they asked for Dr. Acosta's deposition. And as I said, because of this allegation that somebody else besides Dr. Klein was negligent, we felt it was likely that target would be Dr. Acosta. And so when we met with Dr. Acosta to prepare him for his deposition, we went through those aspects of the case in which Dr. Acosta was involved. I want to make one thing clear. I don't know if it was inadvertent. I'm sure it was, but there have been misstatements made about Dr. Acosta's role in this delivery. Dr. Acosta was not present on the evening of the delivery. He was not in the hospital, and he was not a witness to anything that happened at the time of the delivery. He provided the prenatal care only. Dr. Klein, because he was on call that night, was the doctor who delivered. At Dr. Acosta's first deposition, which was in September of 1993, several things occurred, and I might point out that at that time, no expert witnesses had been identified by anybody. Dr. Acosta prepared for this deposition by reviewing that portion of the chart which he had prepared and which he knew about firsthand.
Counsel, may I interrupt, please?
Surely.
What relief are you asking from this court?
I'm not asking for any relief. I'm responding to the request for supervisory writ.
And you are asking us to deny it?
Yes, I'm asking you to deny it.
Okay.
At Dr. Acosta's first deposition, Dr. Acosta began to be getting questions about things that happened when he hadn't been there. And what Dr. Acosta indicated was, I haven't looked at these records since 1989. And I need to look at them, the monitor tracing, I need to look at the clinical records to determine the answers to those questions. I took the position at that time that he had a right to look at the records and spend some time with those records if he was going to have to answer questions about things that happened when he wasn't there. And so that deposition was continued until he could look at those records. Now, I couldn't call the court for an order or for an answer because this occurred at 6:30 in the evening. Likely it was going to take Dr. Acosta an hour, hour and a half, or 2 hours to go through this record. And then it didn't seem to me to be reasonable to continue a deposition at 9 o'clock that might go until midnight. And so I didn't tell Dr. Acosta not to answer the questions or take the position we wouldn't answer the questions. I merely said we're going to continue this deposition until Dr. Acosta has had a chance to look at these portions of the record that he has not seen for 4 years. 4 months later, the plaintiffs made a motion, and that motion in effect said, Mr. Grimstead cannot represent Dr. Acosta. Because of the Klinger case, said Mr. Grimstead can't talk to Dr. Acosta. Even though Mr. Grimstead is responsible for representing the clinic, and in the event Dr. Acosta is negligent, the clinic will be found vicariously liable. And they further said, we ought to get sanctions because Grimstead talked to Dr. Acosta and that was inappropriate. The trial court agreed. Based on Klinger, they said, Mr. Grimstead, you shouldn't have represented Dr. Acosta, you shouldn't have talked to Dr. Acosta, and we're going to impose sanctions. I was astounded, because this is what I've been doing for 30 years, but we abided by the court's rule. From that moment on, we've had no contact with Dr. Acosta. We have abided by the very letter of the court's order. They said you can't call Dr. Acosta because you talked to him inappropriately. They said you have to turn over to the plaintiffs any correspondence you had with Dr. Acosta because you shouldn't have been corresponding with him. We did that. And we complied with the court's order in its entirety. We took it to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals affirmed, again, based on Klinger. They said, based on the Klinger decision, you can't represent Dr. Acosta. They also affirmed the sanctions that were imposed. Either side could have appealed that to this court. Neither did, because we knew the Steinberg decision was on the way. And indeed, very shortly after the Court of Appeals ruled on this case, this court decided Steinberg. We moved for reconsideration based on Steinberg. Judge Dyer said, well, Steinberg is interesting, but it wasn't the law at the time, and I'm going to affirm my previous ruling. I'm not going to change anything. Plaintiffs also moved for reconsideration. They said, we want more sanctions. Judge Dyer said, no. No more sanctions. I know Steinberg's now the law, but we're going to leave things the way they are. And that was the end of it. And that is the sum and substance of my involvement on behalf of Dr. Acosta. I represented him until the day Judge Dyer said, you can't do that, Mr. Grimstead. And from that moment on, I've had nothing further to do with Dr. Acosta. I called the insurance company. I said, I'm sorry, but this is what the court ruled. The insurance company hired Mr. Burnett. And from that moment on, Mr. Burnett handled the representation.
Mr. Grimstead, as you read the Steinberg case, would you now be permitted to do what you couldn't do under Klinger?
You know, that's a really, really tough question for me because I read the Steinberg case a lot of times. Certainly, I need to be able to do that, and I would hope Steinberg, in overruling Klinger, would be read to say a lawyer who is hired to represent a medical clinic or a lawyer who is hired to represent a hospital has to be able to talk to the people who provided the care in order to defend that clinic or that hospital, even if those individuals are not personally named as defendants. Certainly the Steinberg case overruled Cleaver. That we know for sure. I think we need to address, however, the specific issue at some point, and today's not the day, I suspect. We need to direct ourselves to the specific issue of whether Steinberg prohibits any contact between a lawyer representing an entity like a hospital or a clinic and the very doctors and nurses who provided the care. I would hope it would not, Your Honor, and that would be the position I would take, although I don't think Steinberg specifically addresses that issue.
Counsel, are you able to shed any light on the reason why the doctor should not be required to testify? That is, the privilege theory asserted as a legal basis for not requiring the doctor to testify. Do you believe the doctor has a privilege not to respond to that second question?
I believe that we have to differentiate between things that the doctor has as part of his or her personal knowledge. Like, if they're a witness, they were there at the time of the delivery, they were there when something happened, they were there in the surgical suite. Certainly, I think a doctor, whether or not they're being paid, if they were there and they were a witness, has to testify, yes, openly and honestly about what they know and what they observe.
Including opinion testimony that would not require further review or research?
That's a more difficult question. If you ask the doctor then to render opinions about things like standard of care, most doctors are going to say, I need to look at the entire record for that. Most physicians are going to say, I can't make that kind of a snap judgment. The difficult question is where you have a physician like Dr. Acosta, who wasn't even there on the night of the delivery, knows nothing about what happened except what's in the record. You call him in and start saying, now I'm going to ask you questions about whether the guy that was there that night and who did the delivery met the standard of care. That, I think, is absolutely inappropriate and wrong and unfair.
Even if we could clearly answer it, like, if you...